You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Georgina Godwin, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Syrian rebel groups break up with the Syrian National Coalition and pledge to unite under Sharia law. We assess if the Syrian opposition has completely lost its moderate, Western-friendly front.
And Oscar Guardiola Rivera will set the day's agenda. Oscar, what are we looking at today?
Well, the United Nations General Assembly has many detractors, but sometimes, like this year, it can make for powerful drama.
Plus, we discuss the most impressive retail innovators in Japan with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall.
Rather than, you know, the sort of sterile civic space that you normally get with libraries, this is a very warm environment. There's a lot of wood, freestanding shelves. There's a loft as well where the collection of 200,000 books and other reference materials are kept.
And we head to the small town of Marfa, Texas, where an iconic and ironic monument to consumerism risks being demolished by the state.
Definitely interesting, and we wanted to see it because a couple days before we came, I saw the article that they said they might be tearing it down. I figured might as well see it before it's gone.
All that plus we'll talk to our woman in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith, and we may even play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the headlines with our one and only Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Iran's new government says it wants to kickstart talks with world powers to resolve a decade-long dispute over its nuclear program, and it's hoping for a deal in 3 to 6 months. Later today, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is set to hold talks on the issue with the US Secretary of State John Kerry, as well as diplomats from Britain, France, Russia, China and Germany. The meeting, bringing the top US diplomat and the new Iranian foreign minister to the same conference table, will be highly unusual, since the US has not maintained diplomatic relations with Iran since 1980. White House spokesman Jay Carney has reiterated America's position.
Substantive negotiations over Iran's nuclear program will be the test, will provide the test of whether or not Iran is serious about resolving the international community's concerns. And we are engaged in that process. As you know, Secretary Kerry will be with his Iranian counterpart in the P5+1 process this week. So that's the beginning of what we hope will be progress towards resolving this problem.
Syria has continued to dominate discussions at the UN General Assembly in New York. World leaders have continued to call for action to end the civil war, with Italy amongst those condemning the use of chemical weapons. UN inspectors are heading back to Syria to investigate further alleged chemical attacks. The president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, was amongst those to use his address at the UN to discuss Syria.
It's urgent for the Security Council, together with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, to take the necessary decisions to ensure the swift and secure destruction of Syrians' poison gas and nerve agents stocks.
One person was killed and three others wounded in a grenade attack in a supermarket in the Kenyan town of Wajir, about 500 miles northeast of Nairobi. The region is prone to banditry and low-key clan clashes, but it's also suffered sporadic attacks by the Islamist Somali militia group Al-Shabaab, which carried out last weekend's attack in the capital. Police said the man killed was a casual labourer in the town, which is dominated by a Somali population and located near the border with Ethiopia and Somalia. The man suspected of throwing the grenade is said to have suffered serious injuries. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says he intends to take legal action against Airbus because of serious problems with the country's presidential plane following 5 months of maintenance by the company. Maduro said he'd been concerned about flying in the aircraft after it returned from maintenance in Paris and ordered his own technicians to carry out an inspection. He said they discovered a serious fault in one of the wings, and he says that with the help of an international law firm, he is preparing legal actions against Airbus. The Pakistani girl shot by the Taliban last year for attending school has received one of this year's prestigious Clinton Global Citizens Awards during a special ceremony in New York. 16-year-old Malala Yousafzai received this year's Leadership in Civil Society Award. Since being shot, she's co-founded the Malala Fund to continue advocating for universal access to education. And she's urging leaders to focus on education rather than war to resolve the world's problems.
I hope that governments and all responsible people will realize that we cannot end war with a war. We can fight war through dialogue, peace, and education.
The British supermarket chain Asda has withdrawn what it had called a mental patient fancy dress costume. The Halloween costume, which Asda was selling online, cost £20 and included clothing, fake blood, a mask, and a fake meat cleaver. There was widespread criticism, including one from a leading mental health charity, which said it was stunned to discover the outfit. Asda, which is owned by Walmart, says selling the costume was a completely unacceptable error which should never have happened. It's apologised for any offence caused and it's made what it called a sizeable donation to the mental health charity Mind. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, that was Barney Burnham. It is 6 minutes past the hour, 17.06 in Sydney, 11.06 in Moscow, 8.06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Well, let's start as ever with the agenda setter. And this morning we're in the United States. Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a senior lecturer at London's Birkbeck University and a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Oscar, it's the UN General Assembly and very interesting it's proving to be.
Absolutely the case. We all remember Nikita Khrushchev's banging of the shoe and Hugo Chavez's sulfur comment. But this year there was plenty of drama in the UN General Assembly meeting. From the very first speech, Dilma Rousseff, Brazil's president, launched a fierce attack against NSA US spying by saying that personal data of citizens was intercepted indiscriminately, corporate information, often of high economic and even strategic value, was at the center of espionage activity. She said that this not only breaches international law, but also the very principles of relations between friendly nations.
What do you think is going to happen after the General Assembly? Rousseff was calling on the UN to oversee a new global legal system to govern the internet. What would that be?
Well, it would be a sort of legal framework to prevent cyberspace from being used as a weapon of war through espionage, sabotage and attacks against systems and infrastructure of other countries. She said that this was very different from surveillance for the purposes of fighting terrorism. What she pointed out is that using it for the purposes of industrial espionage and gaining economic advantage over friendly nations is simply unacceptable.
Well, that's, of course, she's concerned about Petrobras, the huge Brazilian energy company. But does she perhaps have a personal stake in that? Because let's not forget, she used to be energy minister. She, when she went on to Lula's staff, her predecessor in the role had resigned after a corruption scandal that was involved there. She's now put in place an energy minister who's also been associated with the company. She's got a big history with it. If there are any bodies to be dug up around Petrobras, she knows about it and possibly she's nervous.
Absolutely the case. She's nervous not only about that, but also about the possibility that the big reserves, the oil reserves that have been blunted, Brazil has, this has been pointed out all over the world, perhaps are not as big as it was thought at first. So that could be also very problematic.
A huge impact then, of course, on the economy of the whole of South America, really.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Oscar, another thing you'd like to draw into our attention, there's been some journalists at the UN who've had a funny reaction. They've been kind of, hold on, what did President Obama just say?
That was very interesting because very few journalists over here have focused on that point. During his address to the UN General Assembly, President Obama did point out that the US was ready to use all the means at the disposal of its administration, including military, in order to, as he put it, ensure the free flow of energy from the region, the Middle East, to the world. This is as close to an admission of a use of force beyond the international rule of self-defense as you can get. So quite a few journalists in the United States, for instance, Jeremy Scahill of The Nation, have been wondering, did Obama just say what I think he said? In a sort of open admission that the US is ready to use force in order to conquer areas and take resources from people around the world.
A bold declaration of imperialism, possibly.
Some people have been asking if that is the case. Obama did back against the Russians when he said that America was an exceptional nation. He then defended the Gulf War and said the U.S. would continue to take such actions in pursuit of securing natural resources for themselves and their allies.
So obviously this isn't just something that slipped from President Obama's mouth. There is obviously some kind of a motive for all this. What do you think that could be?
Well, one has to wonder if this was, as you pointed out, a bold declaration of imperialism or just another symptom of Mr. Constitutional Law Professor becoming a security president. In the end, we might look back on this as the moment that the neocon doctrine of military force solidified in the hands of someone whose outlook seemed very different at first.
Now, of course, he's got other problems because we've got a budget crisis looming once again.
This is a huge problem. I mean, I have to say, I wouldn't like to be him. I mean, let us remember that also Obama was waiting on the wings in the UN while Dilma Rousseff was launching her attack. Maybe that also motivated his reaction. But there are also huge problems in Congress. Warnings have grown as the U.S. faces possible default and shutdown. As we saw happening last year, U.S. Congress is once more politically hamstrung. The Republicans are using the debt ceiling debate in order to block Obama's health care, tax policies, and so on and so forth. And the U.S. Treasury has said that by mid-October, it will have only $30 billion on hand, which is enough to cover only a half day's government expenditure. After that, it will be unable to borrow any more money, make any payment interest, and of course, then the government would shut down, and this would send a ripple effect throughout the world.
What do you expect to see happening next, and how is this to be solved?
Well, we all have to hope that it is resolved as it was in the previous occasion, at the last minute. Obama's spokespeople have said so far that he will stand firm, that he will not negotiate with Congress over the government's past commitments. But still, it is clear that the Republicans' use of the debt ceiling debate in Congress is becoming some sort of putting a gun repeatedly against one's head. As one financial advisor put it, you can only put the gun to your head so many times before someone pulls the trigger.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is a yearly occurrence, it would seem. How more often can it happen?
That's the problem. It cannot happen. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that should be used for political purposes. But there you go. Obama not only faces international problems, but he's still facing lack of reasonable debate in U.S. Congress.
Well, that was Oscar Guardiola Rivera, a senior lecturer at London's Birkbeck University. Oscar, thanks so much for joining us today.
Coming up, Syrian Islamist rebels reject Syrian National Coalition. We look at the consequences. Stay tuned.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe. The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
It's 11:15 in Dubai, 8:15 in London and 3:15 a.m. in New York City. Since America started contemplating a strike against Bashar al-Assad's government, one question has kept coming back. What if helping the rebels meant putting al-Qaeda in power? Well now, Syria's rebels are breaking up with the main opposition Syrian National Council, and in a way, with their Western backers too. On Wednesday, some Islamist rebel groups in Syria released a video statement announcing they no longer recognise the authority of the coalition, a group that's been operating out of Istanbul since November last year and has been recognised by over 100 countries.
The rebel statement called on all military and civilian forces to unite under a clear Islamic framework based on Sharia, which should be the sole source of legislation. It urged members of the opposition to reject division and put the interest of the Islamic nation over the interest of each group. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Fawaz Jerjes, director of the Middle East program at LSC. But first, we are on the line with Walid Safour, UK ambassador of the Syrian National Coalition. Welcome to the program. What is your reaction to these latest events?
I think this is not to be exaggerated too much. There was some sort of weak connection in the last few weeks after the nomination of the new presidency in the coalition. This led to some sort of differences, and this weak connection led to the declaration of the 13 groups 2 days ago. I think this can be rectified and amended by strong connection on the one side and by telling them that we are not going to Geneva II without having sure results. I think the armed groups were afraid more by the declaration of Mr. Al-Jarba that he is going to Geneva II without any a clear outcome. This is the reason which arise their apprehensions, and therefore they wanted to tell him, look, you are not the only blame maker. We are on the ground the blame makers.
Well, you talk about Geneva II. It's been postponed several times. Do you think that that's likely to happen again now?
I think the Syrian National Coalition did not say that we are going to Geneva II because there is nothing clear from our point of view, from our side. There is nothing, and it is against, so far it is against to the fixed point of the Syrian National Coalition, to our principles. So far, we will not sit with the criminal regime of Bashar al-Assad, and we will not negotiate with him at all. We only can go to Geneva II if Bashar al-Assad and his regime are able to go.
Thank you very much. That was Walid Safour, the UK representative of the Syrian National Coalition. Now, we're on the line with Fawaz Jerjes, director of the Middle East programme at the London School of Economics, who's currently in Dubai after travelling through Jordan and Egypt. Fawaz, this is not the first time that we've seen division between the rebels. How seriously should we be taking it in this instance?
Well, I mean, I think the Syrian National Coalition and the Syrian people should be taking it very, very seriously. You have three of the major brigades who basically form the backbone of the Free Syrian Army. They said they do not recognize the Syrian National Coalition. They don't recognize the legitimacy of the historical leadership. They called for the application of the Sharia, al-Islamiyya, the Islamic law, as the constitution of the Syrian uprising. This is very serious. It's very serious for a variety of reasons. You have a Nusra Front, part of the 13 coalitions, which subscribes to al-Qaeda's ideology. And the main elements, the main brigades of the Free Syrian Army signed along with the Nusra Front saying they do not recognize the legitimacy of the Syrian National Coalition, and they would like to apply Islamic law as the standard barrier of the Islamic revolution.
Fawaz, what do you think, what should Syrian National Coalition do in this situation, and what can it do?
Well, you know, I mean, it is easy to basically criticize the Syrian National Coalition. They are trying to coalesce, they're trying to establish a government in exile, they're trying to unify the opposition, they're trying to satisfy the Western demands, they are dependent on regional patrons. I mean, you can imagine the challenges facing the Syrian National Coalition. I think the Syrian National Coalition should have basically a delineated roadmap, a vision, a constitution about what it wants. It should basically try to convince the Syrian people. This is a major challenge to the very fundamental ideas of the revolution. The revolution was about what? Democracy, transparency, diversity. It was not about creating an Islamic State along either the Taliban or any other state. And I'm not suggesting that an Islamic state is bad or wrong. That's not the question. But what the military brigades are trying to do is to basically force their own vision, their own Islamist vision, on the Syrian National Coalition and the Syrian people. The big point, there are two big points we need to keep in mind here, regardless of assigning blame or what can be done or not. The first thing is we are seeing the Islamization of the armed opposition inside Syria. This has taken place over the last 1 year or so. Most of the potent, skilled, important brigades have really become Islamicized from the inside out. It's not just about al-Qaeda. The second point, a major divide has basically emerged between the armed opposition inside Syria and the historical leadership of the political opposition. And this is nothing unique about it. In most revolutions, in particular armed conflicts, basically the people who carry the guns determine the future of their countries, whether it was in Bosnia or in Libya or in Syria. And this is not good. It's not good for Syria. It's not good for the Syrian people. The Syrian people basically revolted against Assad, not only to reestablish another authoritarian political system, but to establish a democratic system.
Thank you very much to you, Fawaz Jerjes, Director of the Middle East Programme at the LSE.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, and Georgina Godwin. Now, all this week we have been previewing Monocle magazine's retail special in the October issue. Today we go to Japan, where Kenji Hall, our Asia editor-at-large, describes some of the latest retail innovations, starting with the imaginative use of one of our favourite public spaces, the library. Georgina spoke to Kenji a bit earlier.
This is a library in Takeo City. This is a very small city on the southern island of Kyushu. There are 51,000 residents. Culture Convenience Club, which is the operator of the Tsutaya retail chain, has gone in and said, you know, we can run this library for you and we can do it better and for a lower cost than you can. And what they've done is they've renovated the entire library to look like one of Tsutaya's greatest shops. And they've done a fantastic job.
What does it look like?
Rather than, you know, the sort of sterile civic space that you normally get with libraries, this is a very warm environment. There's a lot of wood, freestanding shelves, and there's a loft as well where the collection of 200,000 books and other reference materials are kept. And so it looks in many ways like a bookstore. There's also a Starbucks cafe inside of the building, which is unusual, especially for this city, which hadn't had a Starbucks before.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that the mayor was quite instrumental in moving this project forward.
Absolutely. Mayor Keisuke Hiwatashi actually approached Culture Convenience Club with this idea of running the city's library. He did this after he visited the Tsutaya bookshop in Daikanyama. This is in Tokyo, and it's one of the model bookstores that Tsutaya has built in recent years. You know, his idea was that if we want to get the full use out of this public institution, we need more people to come. He was also thinking of this public institution as something to attract new residents. You know, in Japan's remote areas, we've seen graying society. We've also seen sort of an outflow to the cities. They're losing a lot of young people, a lot of good talent. And, you know, this was a way for this very small city to create something that would actually attract new residents to the city.
It all sounds very positive, but there have been some grumbles, too, at the commercialization of a building that's actually funded by taxpayers.
That's right. There's also been some confusion in the library itself. You walk in and the commercial area has about 10,000 new books, 600 magazine titles. There are also CDs, music CDs, and movies on DVD to rent. These are all sort of mixed in. There's no distinct border between the bookstore part and the library. And so some people have actually been going into the bookstore, grabbing a book off the shelves and trying to check it out. But the machines automatically tell them, well, this is actually a book that has to be purchased. And so there's been some confusion there. There's also, as you mentioned, been some grumbling about the commercialization of a public institution that's supposed to be there for the public good. The fact that there's a Starbucks on the premises has also not sat well with some people. But, you know, in general, the reception has been great. We've seen just in the first 3 months that the new library opened, it opened in April, there were some 260,000 visitors. That's equivalent to the number of visitors that the library had in 2012. And so far, it looks like a reception has been pretty good.
It's also more visitors than there are residents at Yukishima Messenger. Tell me about this reinventing retail story.
Right, so Yakushima Messenger is a shop, it's a retail shop that specializes in outdoor wear. It also is a business that leads and organizes guided treks around the island. This island, Yakushima, is tiny. It has fewer than 13,200 residents. And it's famous because it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Some of the oldest living cedar trees on the planet are here. And so the environment is actually a very important part of being on this island. And it's actually what attracted Yoshihiro Kikuchi to the island in the first place. He and his wife moved from Tokyo years ago after having visited Hawaii. And they saw how Hawaii was the sort of paradise for them. And they wanted to find something similar in Japan. And they kind of stumbled across it when they visited Yakushima.
And it looks like a thriving business. Just quickly, Kenji, onto the last story I want to mention today, which is about Lexus, who have created this car showroom, but you'd be hard-pressed to even realize that it was cars they were selling.
That's right. I mean, that's the whole point of the space. The space was meant to be a place for people to actually get to know the brand and what it stands for without getting into a Lexus car. The hope was that the space would actually give people a feeling of what the brand was about, what it values, and that sort of thing. And in that sense, they've succeeded wildly.
They've manufactured a glass cube right in the heart of Tokyo with a number of collaborators. Who's been involved?
That's right. So Wink Creative, which is Monocle's sister company, was involved in the design, overall design. Lexus also hired Masamichi Katayama of Wonderwall to design the interior. Masaya Kuroki of fashion brand Kitsune outfitted the senior staff, and Japanese bookstore chain Tsutaya, which we just mentioned, was responsible for curating the library's 500 titles on the second floor. There's also lots of stuff for people who are into cars. On one wall, you have parts from an automobile that have been sort of disassembled and made into sort of a decorative wall. Inside the bathrooms, you have thousands of small model cars. And so it's this sort of combination of design and car paraphernalia that has created this amazing space.
That was Kenji Hall, Monocle's Asia editor at large, previewing some of the features from the retail special in the October issue of the magazine.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll get the local news from Mali, leaf through today's European papers, and hear how the Prada Marfa art installation in West Texas is in a bit of trouble.
Definitely interesting, and we wanted to see it because a couple days before we came, I saw the article that they said they might be tearing it down, and figured might as well see it before it's gone.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Iran's new government says it wants to kickstart talks with world powers to resolve the long-running dispute over its nuclear program, and it's hoping for a deal in 3 to 6 months. Later today, the Iranian foreign minister is set to hold talks on the issue with the US Secretary of State and diplomats from Britain, France, Russia, China and Germany. Syria has continued to dominate discussions at the UN General Assembly in New York. World leaders have repeated their calls for action to end the civil war, and Italy has joined the condemnation of the use of chemical weapons. One person was killed and three others wounded in a grenade blast in a supermarket in the Kenyan town of Wajir, about 500 miles northeast of Nairobi. The region has suffered sporadic attacks by the Islamist Somali militia group Al-Shabaab, which carried out last weekend's attack in the capital. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says he intends to take legal action against Airbus because of serious problems with the country's presidential plane following 5 months of maintenance by the company. The Pakistani girl shot by the Taliban last year for attending school has received one of this year's prestigious Clinton Global Citizens Awards during a special ceremony in New York. 16-year-old Malala Yousafzai received this year's Leadership in Civil Society Award. The British supermarket chain Asda has withdrawn what it had called a mental patient fancy dress costume. Asda says selling the costume was a completely unacceptable error which should never have happened. It's apologised and made a sizeable donation to a mental health charity. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Marcus Hippie.
Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we are joined on the line from Bamako by Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Mali. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Marcus.
Your first story is about four UN peacekeepers who have been sent home after being accused of sexually assaulting a woman.
Indeed. Four Chadian peacekeepers were sent home after they were involved in a sexual assault of a woman in Gao. And there are believed to be more alleged rapists involved in the attack, which took place last Thursday. The story behind it is that 160 peacekeepers from Chad were fed up with their conditions after being for 9 months in the far north of Mali with no leisure activities, shall we say. And they took 40 vehicles, 40 MINUSMA vehicles, and drove 1,000 kilometers south to Gao. And that's where they set out on an orgy of drinking and of other things, which seem to include this alleged rape. The woman who was attacked turned to the UN for medical help. The UN launched an inquiry. But I think what's interesting about it and what that's telling and what needs some action is the fact that the UN now, having carried out this inquiry, can only turn to Chad, the troop country, and say, please will you inquire and please will you issue disciplinary measures against these men. And that's the best the UN can do.
And is Chad likely to comply with that?
Well, Chad, the only thing Chad can do, the only thing the UN can do is kind of put Chad under moral pressure. Chad wants a non-permanent security council, for example. The General Assembly is going on at the moment in New York. So there'll be plenty of people bumping into Chadian President Idriss Deby in the corridors. But that's about as much pressure as the UN can put on Chad. And Chad's a big hero in Mali because Chad has provided so many troops, both to fight along the French and in MINUSMA, 1,500 in MINUSMA.
Alex, let's move on to your next story, and that's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. It's reported to have appointed a Mauritanian and an Algerian to replace members of its leadership killed in Mali. What more can you give us on this story?
Indeed. I mean, I thought I'd mention it because it's quite rare for us to get any detail of any of the Islamist groups' sort of makeups. And we've recently had a merger of two other Islamist groups in the Sahel. That happened in Mauritania, and they've they're creating a joint leadership, which is going to probably be led by a Pakistani. And then you have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which, of course, is the most famous group in this part of the world, whose leader, Abu Zaid, was killed in March by the French. A new Algerian leader has been chosen for Akim, and that's Saeed Abu Mukhatil. Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb was actually the group that was most prominent in the occupation of northern Mali, and which, of course, beheaded the British hostage Edwin Dyer in 2009 and a Frenchman in 2010. Then we have a Mauritanian citizen chosen to replace Mohamed Al-Hassan. He's Abdurrahman, well, that's his nickname, Abdurrahman. And he was the guy who was holding Timbuktu last year. So you have two personalities, one of them Mauritanian, one of them Algerian, both from the region, chosen to lead these groups. That's quite interesting because it means that neither Pakistanis nor Somalis are being brought in for the time being. It suggests that the groups are perhaps a little bit stronger than, for example, the French authorities would like us to believe in the region, because they can still muster a leadership in the region.
Exactly. This all is taking place 9 months after the start of the French intervention in Mali. What's your impression? How strong are the Islamists actually now?
Well, according to UN estimates, there are about 6,000 to 7,000 people in the Malian north who are capable of taking up arms and fighting with them. That doesn't mean that they're dyed in the wool Islamists. That means that they could be local civil defense militias or armed individuals who might perhaps choose to side with the Islamists over the secessionists, because that's really what's going to be the next chapter in the Malian story, whether the secessionist MNLA get the upper hand or the Islamists return, the latter of which I think is unlikely with, as long as the French are around. But, you know, there's still 6,000 to 7,000, according to the UN, who are taking up arms and fighting with Islamist groups in northern Mali, and that will perhaps happen if France or MINUSMA, the UN force, in any way show weakness. But for the time being, of course, we're pretty safe because there's so much international troop presence in Mali.
Now, as we know, the United Nations General Assembly is ongoing in New York, but it's ongoing at the moment without the Senegalese president, who's cut short his trip after riots have erupted in his country. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I thought I might mention it because I think his absence, Macky Sall's absence, might be noticed, but perhaps not the reasons for it. The Senegalese capital, Dakar, has been without water. Parts of it have been without water for 2 weeks. No tap water. This after huge floods at the end of August made life difficult in other ways and actually claimed some lives. And on Tuesday, so the day before Macky Sall's speech at the General Assembly, actually some demonstrations started in Dakar, and they turned into riots yesterday with the police using tear gas on the demonstrators. You can imagine how tempers can get frayed after 2 weeks, after the capital has no water for 2 weeks, and people are having to spend their days going out of town to fetch water from outlying villages and bring it back, or pay people to do so. It would appear that Macky Sall has quite simply decided that the politicians he's left at home can't cope, and he had to turn around and go back from New York, even though the new, quite impressive Prime Minister, Aminata Touré, yesterday went out to the treatment plant, which is blamed for this water shortage, and said that the water officials who are responsible for not repairing it, for bad management, general neglect over years, are going to be held responsible. But that's how serious it was. I had to come back from New York.
Alex, thank you very much indeed. That's Alex DeVar-Smith, Our Woman in Mali.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be right back with a trip to the artist community of Marfa in West Texas, where one famous art installation is causing controversy as many as 8 years after its creation.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has the right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 1540 in Shanghai, 840 here in London. The tiny town of Marfa sits in the middle of the West Texas desert, right at the border with Mexico, and 3 hours from the nearest city. Surrounded on four sides by vast ranch land and mountain ranges, it's the dusty, dying town that renowned minimalist sculptor Donald Judd chose to call home in the early 70s.
Well, since then, Marfa has turned into an enclave in the middle of the desert for loners, artists and makers. But the town has recently found itself caught up in a debate on what is art and what's not. Reporter Alice Quinlan reports.
If you drive the scenic 37 miles west of Marfa, Texas, you'll happen upon Prada Marfa. If you're in the market for a $3,000 handbag, however, you're out of luck. This highwayside store actually isn't a store at all. It's a permanent art installation by artists Elmgreen and Dragset, erected in 2005. The artists chose the location near Marfa to critique the absurdity of luxury goods. Since then, it's become a beloved photo backdrop for the legions of tourists that visit the tiny arts town every year.
I mean, it's definitely interesting, and we wanted to see it because a couple days before we came, I saw the article that they said they might be tearing it down. I figured might as well see it before it's gone.
That's Alex, a tourist in Marfa. And you heard him right. Prada Marfa's days might be numbered. The 8-year-old installation has been dragged into a debate between what's art and what's an advertisement. This past June, hoping to regain some of its cool factor lost since the dawn of the internet, Playboy Enterprises quietly erected what is known as Playboy Marfa. About a mile outside of town, the piece includes a 40-foot-tall neon bunny logo and a 1972 Dodge Charger mounted on a concrete plinth. A mystery installation which immediately became controversial.
To me, it's exploitation, pure and simple.
James Rodewald, a former magazine editor, isn't impressed by the piece.
Well, Marfa gets a lot of attention in the media, and Playboy, as they have said over and over, is in the midst of a rebranding, and capitalizing on the media's fascination with Marfa is a cheap way to get a lot of attention.
The reaction in town has been strong. Many feel that townspeople have been kept intentionally out of the loop. Editorials in the local newspaper have skewered Playboy, demanding an explanation. Others simply call the piece out for being bad art.
I was really shocked by how poorly executed it was, and by the pride that those who put it together took in the piece. It seemed really shoddy, aesthetically not very interesting, intellectually devoid of any interest to me. Everything about it seemed out of place, and still does. We drove by it yesterday, and I just was baffled yet again. What is it doing there?
But what about Prada Marfa?
Well, Prada Marfa is completely different. It wasn't funded by a company. Prada apparently did agree to have their logo used, but I suspect that's because they understand the absurdity of commerce probably better than most. Whereas the Playboy installation was funded completely by Playboy. They had their marketing person out here. It was clearly a commercial endeavor, whereas Prada was generated by an idea from artists, put together by artists with the cooperation of the company, but the two seem to me completely distinct.
Not everyone agrees. In an effort to get Playboy Marfa removed, a local resident called the Texas Department of Transportation to remind them of the Highway Beautification Act of 1965. That act requires that all outdoor advertisements have proper permits, and since Playboy Marfa doesn't, the bunny will have to come down by the end of October. But now people have started asking, why is Prada Marfa allowed to stay, if Playboy Marfa has to go. Local designer Buck Johnston is a fan of both works. Speaking of Playboy Marfa, she muses,
I don't think it's necessarily good art, but in the end, it kind of made me happy. And I like that it's a draw for tourism, and I'm very into that for Marfa. I'm very Marfa-centric, and I like it that it's bringing people here, and we're in the news because of it. You know, I find the Exxon sign in the middle of downtown more offensive than the Playboy Marfa.
Neither Playboy Marfa nor Prada Marfa sought permits under the Highway Beautification Act because they didn't classify the works as advertising. Now, whether the fake Prada shop can remain is up to the Texas Department of Transportation. According to Texas Monthly, the installation is already classified as an illegal outdoor advertising sign, just like Playboy Marfa. For Johnston, TxDOT has no authority to decide what is art and what is advertising.
Well, it's laughable and kind of ridiculous. I mean, do they really know?
While locals and art critics might see a big distinction between Playboy Marfa and Prada Marfa, TxDOT and the law aren't likely to. And tourists see Playboy Marfa as just another quirky attraction in a town where you're as likely to stumble into a gallery as a cowboy. Much of the small town's economy is fueled by tourism, people fascinated by high art in the high desert.
It reminded me a lot of like the art that's already out in Marfa, how like minimalistic that concrete box is. There was just something magical when you don't expect it.
While some see Playboy Marfa as the first nail in the coffin for what attracted artists to Marfa in the first place, a town removed from commercialism and corporate interest, others see it as helping a small town sell itself to the world. For Monocle, I'm Alice Quinlan.
You're with Midori House. Well, in a moment, we'll be leafing through the European front pages. Our researcher, Alexa Firmanish, will be taking us from Le Monde to El Pais. But first, let's listen to a band that's almost as cosmopolitan as she is. This is the Franco-British sextet, The Night Six, with Thinking of You. Franco-British group The Night Six with Thinking of You.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi and Georgina Godwin. It is 16:51 in Tokyo, 10:51 in Kuwait City, 8:51 here in London. Time now to leaf through the European front pages with our Swiss researcher, Alexa Firmanish. Good morning, Alexa.
Good morning, Marcus.
You have Le Monde in front of you. What do you have from there for us?
So to start off with, the French Interior Minister Manuel Valls has come out with some pretty controversial statements that relate to the Roma population within France. He's basically calling on remarks to expel all of their all of France's Roma populations, and this is following a spate of evictions of around 10,000 from temporary camps during the first half of this year.
Very harsh words. What do you think? What is the public reaction in France to his views?
I mean, a lot of people are saying it is quite an outrageous statement. I mean, what he's saying is that they'll never be able to integrate into society. He's saying it's not France's job to deal with the misery of the whole world. And because they'll never integrate, there's no other solution but to essentially kick them out. So, I mean, as you can imagine, a lot of people aren't very happy with this. And, you know, they're pointing to very xenophobic policies, very racist policies.
And do you think that's a reflection of the general mood in France? I mean, we've seen huge xenophobic riots there, you know, in the recent past.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, also, this is quite an interesting timing because a lot of people are pointing to the fact that this is ahead of some municipal elections. And he's sort of gathering votes and sort of supporting some of these smaller locally elected officials who feel like they don't have a lot of power. And they have to deal with some of these domestic issues. And so it's also a political, not just a moral game that he's playing. But the EU has come out criticizing it and saying, you know, they've sent a warning to Paris saying this goes against the EU freedom of movement mentality.
What do you think is going to happen next regarding this discussion?
I think we'll wait to see. I don't think that France will be able to expel all of the Roma population. I think Amnesty International, human rights groups are going to step in. You simply can't do that.
Yeah, although it is happening all over Europe, isn't it? And Britain, too, has been having huge problems and has been pointing to the problems when Romanians start flooding into, or that's the word that's used, flooding in, the alarmist word that's used, flooding into Europe when the rules change.
Yeah, and I mean, also, you know, during times of economic hardship, people always look to the foreigner with this sort of attitude, you know, of fear and resentment, and it tends to also be a societal outlet.
Well, moving on to another story, a bit of culture for change, a new exhibition has opened.
Yes, this is in the Musée d'Orsay, also in Paris, and it's on the naked male form. So you have over 200 paintings, sculptures and photographs of the naked male in this sort of very traditional museum. It's also a bit controversial. The president of the museum says he's been wanting to do it for the past 10 or 15 years, but that people weren't ready.
So what is the controversy all about?
I mean, the controversy is just having all of these naked male figures in a museum.
And yet, for centuries, it's been acceptable to have naked female figures in museums and in art. So suddenly, but it's not okay to see men.
It's a very interesting duality, actually. And but the piece actually criticizes the exhibit and says he compares it to a 1995 female masculine exhibit that was in the Centre Pompidou, and that this focus on the relation between men and women and is a lot more beautiful. And he's saying that in this exhibit, the pieces are sort of spread out very hazardously. There doesn't seem to be any sort of chronological order, not a lot of explanation. Also, he's saying that they've missed a very big opportunity to sort of explore the homoerotic, which is a big theme. I mean, as you were saying, if you go back to ancient Greece, the male nude and the sort of homoeroticism was a very, very large component of that.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've just been looking at online.
Oh, you're looking at the photos, aren't you?
I certainly am. Some of them are very gorgeous, actually. But as you were talking about the whole homoerotic side of it, as you were saying, actually, there's been some criticism that it ends in more homoerotic works with the man as an object of desire and the temptation of the male sections. But that there was also a lot of very heterosexual artists who've been included in this.
Yes, I mean, of course. But, for example, they put this sculpture of a German artist who worked for Hitler alongside a photograph of three naked footballers, apart from their socks, in the colours of the French flag. So it just seems like it's a little bit random.
Well, Georgina is already booking her trip to Paris. But do you think this exhibition is going to be hit besides?
We'll see. We'll see. It is open this week, I'm sure. I mean, you know, we'll be going, hopefully.
Well, let's move on to Spain next. There is an interesting discussion taking place in Spain about which time zone it should choose.
Well, I think this is very interesting because I never thought of it. But if you look at a map of Spain and of Europe, here I have one, Spain is actually in the same time zone as the UK. And it was just back in 1942 during the World War II for political reasons that Spain switched to being in the main European time zone. And now there's a big push in Congress to move their time zone back to the UK GMT time zone. And they point to a lot of the Spain customs saying, you know, the Spanish always have late lunches, they always eat late. But actually, if you think about it, that's our 8 p.m., that's our 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. So they point to a lot of these societal ills of low productivity, long lunches, not a lot of time for personal life and rest on their time zone.
But if you changed it, that would be a massive overhaul, wouldn't it? With huge disruption.
I mean, it would be. You have to rehaul all the working hours. You have to get rid of more just societal norms of, you know, mentally having a two-hour lunch break. Even, I mean, the article goes into television times and peak hours of, you know, major shows.
I'm really confused now because I'm trying to think, don't they change the clocks anyway 1 hour? So if they would just choose a different time zone, it wouldn't be such a big hassle, would it?
No, but it would be, I mean, even we change it here, so it would have. So basically, right now it's an hour ahead in Spain, but Spain would be on our time zone, not France's time zone, which is its neighbour.
This is just too confusing for me. I'm an African; it's beyond me. We just keep the same time. The sun comes up and then it goes down again.
But anyhow, that would be sure definitely make business easier between, say, London and Madrid and Barcelona. That was Alexa Furman, Monocle's researcher. Thank you very much for this.
And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Ehruj. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, it's Culture with Rob Bound. Briefing is at midday with Tom Edwards, and at 1800 hours London time, be sure to catch Aperitivo. That's the latest addition to Monocle 24. Aperitivo broadcasts live from our studios at Midori House, and we'll also cut to the Monocle Cafe each day, where we'll catch up with special guests. I'll be back with Sophie Grove for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Georgina Godwin.
And from me, Marcus Hippi.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.